All right, well, welcome to the next session. This one, Architecting Resilient Cloud Applications. We'll walk through some of the technologies, patterns, practices, and a lot of demonstrations of how do you take custom applications and make them work successfully in the cloud. So my name is Richard Sirota. I'm the Director of Product Management for the CenturyLink Cloud, a public enterprise infrastructure as a service available in nodes around the world. Also Microsoft MVP for the last 7 years or so. I write for InfoQ as a journalist for cloud, also work for Pluralsight, so go visit their booth out there, and I've written a few books on application architecture. So we'll start off with the quick, where are we? So at this point, 69% of companies, according to a survey last fall, are looking at moving some of their business-critical apps, ERP apps, not just the toy stuff, to the cloud by the end of this year. That means there's a lot of things moving. It's not just the public-facing internet apps. It's not just kind of simple toy stuff. It's the legitimate business apps. So given that new reality, how are we going to handle that, the problem that comes with it, which is cloud's different than on-premises, right? They're different sorts of containers. What you have in the cloud is going to be run different, maintained different, architect differently than what you have on-premises. And it's not saying one's better than the other, but they are simply different types of containers. So how are we going to tackle that difference? Specifically, if your strategy is to lift and shift, like I'm just going to take apps out of my data center and push them to the public cloud, odds are you're going to be a little disappointed because you're not going to take advantage of what's there, and some concepts don't translate cleanly. So we'll spend some time today talking through those considerations with a lot of demonstrations. So what we're trying to get to a point is a point of resilience, right? It's the topic that I've put in the title. It's how are we making sure that all applications, whether they're big ones or small ones, can have a certain uptime that you want to guarantee, right? That they can survive failures because things will fail in the cloud. So it doesn't just have to be like the Facebook level examples of crazy architecture that's made sure that things will never fail across the world, but how do you still do some of those things for any of the applications that you want to run in the public cloud? It really comes down to you can pay for whatever resilience you want now. So now, not necessarily it's, hey, we don't have the gear, we can't do something in our data center. At this point, you can choose, I'd like to be this resilient and pay for that and get global distribution of your application. So we're gonna do three things. We're gonna walk through some core architecture principles that outline what are the things you have to think about when you're building, architecting, deploying cloud scale applications. We're gonna talk about some specific patterns about how do you take some of these implementations and actually build them in a way that will work nicely in the cloud. And then finally, I'm going to walk through a technology demonstration. So this time last year, I taught a course for Pluralsight on highly available Amazon applications. So I thought it would be fun to take that exact same application and make it highly available in Microsoft Azure. So we'll walk through all of those layers of the app, from storage up to CDN, routing, load balancing, database, all that stuff, redo each one of those so that it would work in a public cloud environment. All in 71 minutes. I like our chances. So let's talk about some of the principles. What are the things you need to think about, care about when you're architecting a highly available application? Some of these may feel obvious, but as you drill into them, it's, you know, things like plan for failure are an overarching concern, right? Things will fail. As much as people can put SLAs out there, which are really just worth exactly what they're written on, because it's still just a credit if something goes down, how can you build around knowing that individual components will go down at some point? Are you looking in your application for single points of failure? I mean, that's really going to be your strategy over and over, is look at every single tier of your app and say, what happens when this fails? Because it's not a if, it's a when. How do you architect looking for those failures and architect around that? Statelessness. So how are you making sure that there is no persistent state on your web application servers, on your virtual machines where necessary, at least for a website, so that I can add and remove nodes seamlessly without having to figure out, well, what did this thing store on it? Oh, it crashed. I have to recover these database transactions I hadn't committed yet, things like that. So you're looking at ruthlessly making your applications as stateless as possible from configuration standpoint and so forth, because you're trying to think about, let's say I unplug these boxes. I mean, we know that, you know, Amazon's got their chaos monkey that Netflix wrote about going, that goes in the data center and just shuts off virtual machines randomly to see how the application responds. If you unleash the chaos monkey in your data center, I would think most of our apps will go off in 3 seconds. But even if you did it in your public cloud, could your app withstand just me randomly going into your account and turning off servers? If no, statelessness is sometimes one of those pieces where you've got things that machine better stay up or else I'm in trouble. You can't have that in a highly resilient, available application. So ideally with this, no server knows about another server from a server-to-server perspective, right? It's you're linking virtual endpoints. If that one server goes down, I shouldn't have to change those 10 others because it has to point somewhere differently. There should never be a server-to-server connection in that environment, always virtual endpoints that I can swap out when I change the gear underneath or when I change my VMs underneath. The next one is that scale-out question. So are you building for scale-out? Are you building with scale in mind from day one? So it's great when you can scale things up, right? I can add more CPU, memory, storage. That's great. Public cloud doesn't make that super easy. Now, you know, plug for us, CenturyLink Cloud makes that really easy to scale up and down without rebooting. But most public clouds are, you have to switch instance sizes. It makes you do a reboot or takes the server offline. So you also have to think, how do I keep adding more resources outbound? So what happens when I do that? Do I have to update my load balancer? Does the database change? Are there jobs that change? Imagine, you know, run that thought exercise to say, what happens if I double my fleet of servers in the next half hour? And what happens when I reduce that in half 20 minutes later? What things have to happen so that that doesn't completely screw up my application? And also then the question is, how do you manage that? What happens when you go from 20 servers that gracefully run to 100 because all of a sudden your load's up, mobile users are hitting the app? Are you able to manage that? How do you patch that? How do you manage that at scale? Or does your infrastructure kind of collapse when you have to do configuration managements, all those sort of changes that you often tie to infrastructure in your back end, monitoring, security? Has your system fallen apart because you just tripled the scale? Because you're going to face that at some point in a cloud app. So have you thought about, how do I manage for scale? How am I going to be ready for that? The next one is thinking about being event-driven and asynchronous. So removing any remote procedure call sort of stuff, right, where I'm tightly coupling two things via service interface or whatever, but I want to reduce my coupling. I want to make sure that this service layer can scale completely independently of this one, right? My web traffic might be going nuts, but I don't really have to scale my database at the same time because maybe it's a different type of traffic. It's not hitting the database. So I want to know I can ramp up all of my web servers, not touch my database server, everything's cool. Or vice versa. So how am I decoupling my layers as much as possible, passing events between them, so it's not just, hey, here's you go do something, but hey, a customer just signed up, or an employee just got fired, whatever. You're passing events around and responding to those accordingly, asynchronously. So I'm just doing handoffs here. I'm not waiting for one thing to do the next, kind of all this tight coupling that prevents me from scaling. The next one's a security piece. So again, as you're building these resilient apps, you're building things at scale, network security, you hate to say it's dead, but the idea of if I have a hardened network, I'm good to go, that concept's kind of irrelevant now because there's an analogy of I can build this giant castle with these big walls, but what happens when all the villagers are running around the countryside? Like, your data moves around, right? People are walking around with mobile devices. Data is transferring between software as a service applications. So just trying to secure the perimeter is meaningless. It's important. It's a good thing. But you have to think about, how is my data secured at rest? How is it secured in transit everywhere? How do I not trust all these endpoints when I'm transferring things through? So you have to be looking at your services that you're building here, and how does each one have a security profile, from single sign-on for management to how is it storing the data, who has access to it? All those things come into play. Just having a nice firewall doesn't really give you security nowadays. The next kind of principle that we think about is monitoring. So when I look at monitoring, you know, latency in a web application, I think we all know, is often worse than the thing just being offline. I mean, when you're sitting there waiting for 10 seconds, 30 seconds, 50 seconds for something to run, I'd rather it just be unavailable, right? A slow internet's almost worse than no internet. Sometimes the same as in a public cloud application. So do I have the right monitoring in place to know that? Or am I just monitoring servers? Like, you can't monitor servers anymore, you monitor services. I'm thinking about the broader thing. How do all the pieces weave together from network and storage and compute to delivering me a service health, not necessarily just is this server running hot or not? So when you think about monitoring, you're monitoring the whole thing. And we'll talk about patterns and technology for that shortly, but something else to keep in mind. The next one's, if you've heard the term, eventual consistency. Again, the idea that there can be a period of time, especially in modern NoSQL databases, where data isn't the same in all the places. Now that might be microseconds, it might be a couple of minutes, but that you're not doing this atomic transaction where I'm updating all these six places and I can't move until they've all committed. Instead, with so many of these new NoSQL databases, from Cassandra to React to Mongo to Couch, All of these let you do very distributed, scaled-out database systems because they can work in an eventually consistent model where data is eventually replicated very quickly, but I'm not necessarily doing that same kind of transaction. So thinking about systems like that, when I need to have data available around the world, does it make sense to have a single relational database sitting in the central US, or does it make sense to have a strategy where my data is actually closer to the user in various locations? I can sacrifice the transactional nature of it in order to get that performance boost and availability. The next one's thinking about diverse services in the public cloud. So, you know, the analogy, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I think we've all done that before, right? You know this sort of SQL integration tool, or you're a BizTalk integration guy where you can integrate the world with it. When you get to the public cloud and you have so many options for things like storage, right? Block storage, object storage, caches, CDNs, relational databases, NoSQL, there's a lot of ways to do storage, a lot of ways to do compute, right? I can do, in a cloud world, I can do private clouds, I can do bare metal, I can do public infrastructure as a service, PaaS. I have a lot of ways I can run my apps. So when you start looking at moving to a cloud environment and migrating apps, what is the right host? What's the right storage? How am I supposed to do security? Those are all very different answers than what you likely have in your own data center today. So are you thinking in those terms, thinking about the best thing, maybe not even the one you're most comfortable with right now? You know, the final one I'll cover here is the idea of self-healing, which brings us almost back to planning for failure and bookending this, is if you do all this stuff right, you've got applications that can handle failures, bursts of traffic, things going offline, without necessarily paging you at 3 a.m. telling you something's broken, right? It's about how do these apps have enough intelligence, often because the platform provides it, that lets you immediately add resources, remove resources, do notifications, shut things off. All of those things, you're trying to get to this point where these larger and larger apps can really recover from failure gracefully, in some cases without any involvement from yourself or from a manual intervention. So next up, I wanted to walk through some patterns. Now I have grossly cribbed and plagiarized, in a good way, from a great white paper the Microsoft Patterns and Practices team has put out there. It's called Cloud Design Patterns, Prescriptive Architecture Guidance for Cloud Apps. Really good paper. It's got about 24 patterns called out of when do you use them, what are they, what are the trade-offs. And so I wanted to pull out a few of those that really impact when I'm designing for cloud. Now, they're not unique to cloud. I can still do this on-premise apps, and hopefully you are doing this in many cases. But they're even more important when you move to a cloud environment. And also, you can run these in any cloud, right? This whole session, obviously I'm focusing on Microsoft Azure here, but really any of these patterns, these technology solutions, I can run this in any cloud in some fashion. It's going to be easier in some more than others. But the key is to take the patterns and the practices, not just the technology, away from this. So what's the first one? So the first one I wanted to talk through is the cache-aside pattern. So in this sort of pattern, you look at, you know, caching is great, right? Instead of going to my database for everything, I can use a cache that has some of my data, a subset of it, available to me. So I'm not pegging my database. Instead, I'm distributing this out to a cache. So some cache services support this sort of read-through and write-behind capability. Read-through meaning when I ask for something from the cache, it's not there, it can transparently go and get it, bring it back, put it in the cache, and return it to me. Fantastic. There's also the write-behind, which is I can make changes to things in the cache, and then it'll go ahead and synchronize that with the data source. Those are nice if you can get that sort of cache environment. But you can also simulate some of that using a pattern like this. So I can simulate read-through using the numbered things I showed here, where you might request something from the cache. It's not there. If it's not, you read it from whatever data store you have. And when you get it back, you store a copy in the cache and give it back to the user so that you're constantly keeping the cache fresh with whatever is in the data store, especially if it's missing or if it's expired, and you can do it that way. So you can also simulate a write behind that way so that when you make changes to your data store, you also expire the version of the object you have in cache. The next request comes in, says it's not here, let me go get it again fresh from the repository. So using this sort of cache-aside strategy lets you offload some of your heavy transactional data, and we'll walk through the technology of this that Azure offers in a minute. But the key is this sort of pattern really helps you distribute what's the data, right? Most of our apps are extremely read-heavy. 2/3 or more of our traffic, I'm sure, is reading the data versus writing to it. Something like a cache solution is really going to help with that. Next one's a circuit breaker. This one, if you're familiar with this, the idea here is that some faults are inevitable, right? Especially as we start building these cloud apps where you have a lot of distributed things, right? And there's going to be a network hiccup. There's going to be a quick overloaded service that doesn't know what to do. But for the most part, you recover from those, right? We use retries. We use other techniques to quickly recover from those sort of transient failures. So what happens, though, when there are errors that take longer to fix? And sometimes they're manual, right? The whole system went offline. The data center is unavailable. Service is offline. How do you make sure that the app isn't trying to call something that is unlikely to succeed? That's really your problem, right? I know this thing is broken. And if I keep calling it, I'm going to cause cascading failures because maybe while this thing's trying to call it and it's holding all the threads waiting for a response, this other service is also trying to do stuff and now it can't do anything. And then you just have this cascading failure across your app because of one unavailable service. So in a circuit breaker sort of pattern, what you're doing is preventing an app from performing an action that's likely to fail. And so by doing this, you really have a proxy that sits there and monitors the success rate of these services. And what it's doing is seeing if there's a lot of failures happening, it can put it into a closed state and immediately return a fault, kind of shown in the picture here. And you've got either a timer or some other technique that you use to open it back up again a little bit a few minutes later. So let's say after 10 minutes or a configurable value or even user-driven where you can click a button to shut open, close that port, it tries and it only opens up some of the traffic. 10% of the traffic's now allowed to call the service. If all of those succeed, you open it up all the way. All of them fail, close it back up again. So using this sort of pattern is really handy when you've got distributed systems all over the place and you want to make sure that this one failure doesn't break me and I know how to handle the failure, right? I mean, if it throws an exception and your whole app bombs out, this isn't really helping you that much. But if you're able to catch that exception and fall back to something else, right? A cached version of your data or a graceful message that says, yeah, we can't submit your order at this time. Maybe we'll drop it to a queue instead until that application comes online. So you can still need a proper response to a failure. But using something like a circuit breaker keeps that service from constantly failing and causing other problems downstream. Next up is the idea of a competing consumer pattern. So this is when you have a lot of apps processing a lot of events, and you don't necessarily want to process them synchronously. Imagine submitting a bunch of orders into something. You might have a lot of applications that are all feeding a particular data type, event type, whatever it would be. They're all pushing that in there, and you want to process that asynchronously on the back end. Now, you might not want to have that one recipient get overloaded. So the idea of a competing consumer is I can have multiple instances of that service running, all of them pulling the messages and working on them as they can, so I can spread the load, right? So even though I've got a bunch of people upstream pummeling me with data, I can make an equivalent number of things downstream stand up to start pulling off that data. But I can still use something like a queue, which sits in the middle and gives me some durable messaging. It can do some of that rate throttling for me. And so using a competing consumer model works really nice there when you have a queue because it is reliable, because it can handle large volumes. Now, of course, ordering can be an issue here, right? If I throw in 100 messages and I have five services all pulling off of it, there's a decent chance that I pull something out of order. So you've got to be prepared for that sort of thing. But this sort of model works really nicely in these cloud environments where you have some very bursty upstream apps that may just start pummeling your system. And instead of tight coupling, where those upstream web apps go right to your database and maybe take your database offline because you just got an influx of write requests, I can stick a queue in the middle that's going to sit there and kind of do some rate limiting for me and hold that data until I'm ready to keep processing it on the back end. Next one is the command and query responsibility segregation pattern, which is quite a mouthful, hence I shortened it also to fit on a slide. But the idea here is that in a lot of systems, your create, read, update, delete operations are applied against the same data representation, right? You've got your database, you've got your table, all of my actions go against that same representation of the data. In this sort of pattern, you recognize that sometimes the needs of both are different, where when I'm doing reads, there might be a different set of fields I get back than I even care about on writes, or I've got different security concerns of who's allowed to read data versus write data, not to mention contention, where do I want everybody pummeling that same representation of data, or do I use something like this where I'm segregating the operations, the read from the write through separate interfaces. Those interfaces could be in the same repository, or I could even split them out into different repositories where there's literally different physical stores that can have their own performance and sizing. They're going to help with my scalability, and I can have different security controls on each of those. So in this case, what can be a little tricky is now that piece that queries these kind of has to know about those two things. They have to recognize the different models. But this can be a really nice way, and you'll see this sometimes with read replicas. They're becoming more available now. Azure in SQL just added this, where you can set up these read-only replicas of a database that are asynchronously and eventually consistent. updated, but I can just go at that read one and make that a certain size, and I can have my main repository that supports reads and writes, but I can point my traffic to one or the other based on the usage. The next one that comes in handy in the cloud, especially, again, as you're thinking about building scalable, resilient apps, is using an external configuration store. So how many apps do we all build that have that web config file right in there with the file, and that goes with my app to all of my servers? I've got this fleet of servers with local app config files, web config files. That's fine, but does that really scale well? When I have to change one config, do I want to update 50 servers? Do I even want to do a redeployment to update a connection string to maybe a failover in a primary database, or I swapped out cache providers and I have to change that? That gets really cumbersome. So the idea of using an external config store is using something like a cache or an external storage service to store some of the key metadata, especially if you're dealing with maybe more complex configs. Maybe that's an image. Maybe there's things that don't fit into a traditional web config file, really complex types. I can use these external providers, whether that be a caching service again or a storage service, that I can access key flags and triggers. And then when I make an update, I make it once. So that's going to probably help with my performance, my maintainability, by using an external config that pulls from a storage and can update the cache. It's really the idea there. Next one to talk through is federated identity policies, or pattern in this case. So how many users, I mean, if I had a show of hands just for kicks and giggles, if you think of yourself and your application, and we'll start with a high number, how many people have more than 30 username passwords to access everything in their application? Everything in our environment, like you have that many different sorts of apps. No? Look at you guys. One, few the proud. 10? You have 10 different username passwords to do your job, at least? Who never raises their hand even if I offered free candy? Perfect. So, you know, right now, if my company fired me today, they'd have to shut off my access in about 22 systems. I guess if I say the wrong thing here, who knows? But that's a lot. And a lot of it's because we use a lot of SaaS applications. So I've got all sorts of passwords for my planning systems and our marketing systems, my product management planning systems, our GitHub repo. I mean, all these different places, I have different credentials. So as you think about how, that's not really maintainable, right? There's a security problem of me, which I don't do, but reusing passwords. Everyone just adds the increment at the end, right? But you know, you're going to reuse the password. That's not good. Obviously, if one is breached, then I can use that all over the place. There's problems with people then writing it down and having that, you know, list of sticky note passwords on their monitor, which is no good. Then there's how do I handle the hire fire scenario, right? When you do let someone go or they switch roles or you've hired someone, that can't be this complex onboarding where you're provisioning them in 92 places. So as you think about all that stuff, the idea is separating authentication from your code. And using federated identity means my code can still do some authorization things. It's typically more coupled with the app. But the authentication piece, who are you and do I trust you? I can use federated identity with a trusted third party. So again, in this example, your numbers are, the number one is your web app trusts your identity provider, right? There's a trust established there. You've exchanged certificates, you've established a trust relationship. When my web app needs to get credentials from someone, I can make a request to that service, get back a token of some sort, which then I can pass to that web app that I can trust that, and I can verify that to make sure it hasn't been tampered with. But in that case, my applications never have to care about storing your username, password. If I onboard a user, you just have access to all those systems. So as you start deploying more and more cloud things, using local identity repositories is not going to scale for you. So how can I use my on-premises Active Directory? How can I use Windows, Microsoft Azure Active Directory? How can I use these third-party repositories and get out of the business of doing username, password stuff, which is hard and not worth the effort? Let somebody else do it securely, and let's link to that. Downside of that, of course, is now you're coupled to a provider that if they're offline, you are completely out of luck. So there's always going to be risks with each one of these, but I'd probably rather accept that risk than trusting every one of our developers to build their own authentication solution. The next one touches upon the monitoring that we talked about a few minutes ago, is how do you think about endpoint monitoring? How are you effectively monitoring your app where you have less control? You're subject to whatever data is provided by that cloud provider, right? You can't necessarily stick your agents on their hypervisor. That doesn't work. So you're at the mercy of what they offer you. So as you think about how do I monitor in that environment, you're looking at, in this case, sending a request to a specific endpoint you set up for monitoring. And that endpoint might look at the size of your systems and say, you know what, this thing has so many CPUs allocated right now, it just got scaled. Or here's the latency between the disk. Here's the database size left. Here's a number of metrics that I care about. And I can call one endpoint, get back that health check that then I can make some decisions on to find out, is my app healthy? I don't care if this one web server is healthy. In the cloud, I can kill that and stand up another one and get back to work. I care about, is my whole thing in a healthy state? Is the network latency bad right now? Is my CDN service not providing my data back in a quick fashion? So in this pattern, you're defining an endpoint that actually flexes your system and returns back a sense of health to the caller, who can then make an intelligent choice of, I have to start scaling these resources, or something else is going wrong, let me talk to my provider of networking. Something that gives you more intelligence than just this server is returning a green. Maybe that doesn't really help you in the world. So you have to think about what's the right data to return. You don't want to do too much. If I'm calling this endpoint every 30 seconds and accidentally destroying my system by running all these complex monitoring health checks, I've defeated the purpose. So you're thinking about, how often do I do this? What's the right response? Just a 200 OK message is probably too limited. So what's the right data? What's the right frequency comes into play? But this sort of thing is a big strategic advantage when you're monitoring at scale. Next one's a queue load leveling pattern. This is kind of the stepbrother to the competing consumer pattern. In this case, you're really thinking about, especially if you start linking on-premises stuff to the cloud, right? Hybrid scenarios, which are the buzzword of the day, maybe the conference, who knows. Everyone likes to talk hybrid. So in hybrid, where I might be using my on-premises ERP system as a data repository, I'm calling a web service that sits on-premises from something in the cloud, that's great, but how do I prevent completely pummeling that system that isn't capable of handling it? You know, many of our on-premises systems were not made for web scale or cloud scale, at least, where I just influx dozens and hundreds and thousands of requests simultaneously. So in a load leveling pattern, what you can do is actually inject a queue again. In this case, I don't want multiple consumers. I want a single consumer that can process this as fast as I want it to. So imagine this being that legacy system you have on premises that isn't going to scale to the cloud. I can pummel it from all sorts of sources, and I can have that data sit in the queue, and I'm just going to pull them off one at a time as fast as I can handle it. It doesn't matter if that queue keeps getting bigger. My app is going to go crazy if I just let the whole thing through. So I'm just going to let it level that load out so it always comes out at the same rate. So that's a really powerful pattern when you're linking hybrid, these hybrid scenarios where those legacy systems don't have to be scaled to fit at cloud level, right? They can just stay as they are, but I can control the intake that they have. Next one's runtime reconfigure pattern. So none of us really are getting, you know, in a public cloud or even the public apps we use on the cloud today, the idea of downtime, kind of lame, right? I mean, like Facebook, LinkedIn, my email never goes down for maintenance on a Thursday night. That's not really the way it works. It works on continuous deployment of things, not taking things offline. So in this sort of pattern, it's how do I even update the config on the fly, right? Where I don't have to reboot my app just because I've updated a config file. So in this sort of pattern, the idea is how do I, in flight, check for changes? Maybe it's an event hook on a file, or maybe it's just a push where it's polling and saying this config just changed. How do I take that information and make one of two choices? I'm either going to apply it immediately because I recognize that this sort of change isn't going to break anything. I don't have to restart it for it to see it. Just make the change. Or maybe it does require a reboot of the service at least, hopefully not the whole server, but at least I have to bounce the service to recognize it, queue it up for that for at least the next restart, or trigger it if you have a massive fleet of servers and you want to do a rolling update. But in this sort of model, think about what would it take for this application to never go offline when I make an update to it, both from a config perspective first and then from a code perspective. Since I would think for most of us, our apps now have a much wider usage profile. It's not just 9 to 5 anymore for a lot of our applications. It's people in different geographies. It's people working off hours. It's people on their mobile device. So how am I facing all those situations and not taking my system offline because there is no convenient period anymore to do that? Next one up is sharding. So the idea of sharding is, as you look at cloud apps with their massive data storage needs and lots of concurrent users, there's data sovereignty concerns where you don't want data to be sitting in certain geographies, the snooping US people. So I want to make sure I can split this data out. How do I handle that? I can scale vertically only so much, right? There's only so big of a VM I can stand up in Azure and other locations. I can only throw so much horsepower at a single box. So how do I start scaling databases out? So scaling vertically is good, but when I scale horizontally, the key is how do I split the data up? And so NoSQL databases make this relatively easy, where you can add more nodes relatively infinitely in different geographies, and they're just going to synchronize with no problem. Relational databases can be a little hairier, but even SQL Server makes that a little easier now. We'll talk about that in a moment. But decision making is key, right? What's the right way to split this? If it's a multi-tenant app, I might split it by each tenant. If it's geography-based, I might split it based on the different users being in different geos so I can spread the shards over different regions. Maybe I just want to distribute loads so that there's no hotspots and no one shard is getting all the traffic while the other ones are sitting idle. So thinking about what matters to you, profile your data, think about what's the right way to split it, but sharding is a nice way to do it. Of course, the challenge could be that little gear in the middle is now I need some intelligence to know where the heck do I go for my data? I need this piece of information, where is it? So I need something that's intelligent to say, this data is part of this shard based on a key. I'm going to go get it from here. I'm writing this data. I got to write it to here. And so you have to have some intelligence in the middle. It's not just magic, unless you're using NoSQL databases where it's a little more magic. Finally, the static content hosting pattern. I wanted to point this one out as well, because this is where cloud also takes advantage of this. This is harder to do this in just a private environment. But apps have a lot of static content, right? JavaScript files, CSS files, even videos, movies, images, a lot of content that's not regularly changing. So the idea is, can I take that content, decouple it from my application, and push it to a highly available repository that I can then just access from there, let offload some of that work? That's not going to work if that data is changing every 5 minutes. Clearly, transactional data doesn't go in a sense like that. But how do I take some of that static information and push it out there? So Azure makes that easy. That's one of the first things we're going to walk through. But the key is when I'm doing this, I'm continuing to remove these single points of failure, because these systems that do this static hosting, very well geographically distributed, they take care of a lot of that for me. So offloading some of the responsibility from doing this myself. So let's talk through some of the technology in our remaining time. What I want to walk through is taking a sample application and showing you at each tier, how did I have to configure this so that it ran in a highly available fashion in the Microsoft Azure environment. Once again, the caveat, I can still do most of these things in every other cloud, so as much as you're here and maybe you love Azure and you've got that t-shirt on or something, if you're loving another cloud, you can probably do a lot of these things, but the key is do these things, right? That's the takeaway, hopefully, is think about these things and how do I implement them in your environment in an exciting way. So let's say we start with a traditional application. It's a web app. It's got a relational database. It's running in a single data center. You know, I've got this running on my laptop right now using a local SQL database and IIS. That's great. I maybe even put a load balancer in front if I'm just running some VMs for a testing purpose. But this probably looks like a lot of apps in our data centers, right, where they're just kind of running out there. It's probably even a shared database server you're sharing with some other apps. You thought you were doing a great job of making it available by putting it on two web servers. I mean, I've done that a lot. But as we take a step further, we can probably point out dozens of single points of failure across an application like this. So how do we take the next step? So we're going to move to an architecture that looks like this. I'm going to go piece by piece around it. So let's talk about blob storage. So in this case, when we talk about blob storage, we're talking about Azure storage. Azure storage offers blob storage, table storage, queue storage, different ways to store data redundantly in the cloud. Blob storage is for this unstructured data, kind of like an object storage, where I can have things that are hundreds of gigabytes in size for individual objects, think VM files, backups, movies, images, whatever. And I can have a whole 200 terabytes of storage for a given account. So this is lots of data that I simply want to push off to a public cloud environment. So why would I use this in this application? Well, I've got some static content. Instead of putting it on each web app server, I can store it instead in a blob storage. And then if I want to update my logo because it's Christmas and I want to change my color scheme, really superficial like that, I can just change it right here. Everybody just gets it. I don't have to go push an update to 10 servers. I can simply change my one place, which is still redundant underneath the covers, but it's one place I can make my changes to for static content. Hey, here's a new JavaScript file for the next version of Bootstrap. Here's the next version of this. I've got single place to update versus all the individual ones. So how does this work for redundancy? Each one of these ones I'm going to talk through, I want to talk through the redundancy piece because that's what hopefully matters to the talk. So how do I do redundancy with blob storage? So there's three things. There's locally redundant storage. That's the first setting you can do in blob storage. What this does is copy your data to three different nodes in this very same region. All right, that's pretty cool, right? Something goes down, it chose to just swap over to the other one. No harm, no foul. You didn't really know the difference. You can also do geo-redundant storage. So in this case, you've got your three local ones, and then you've got an asynchronous replication to another data center or another region that's at least a few hundred miles away, and it makes another three copies. So I've got six copies of things floating around. It's a lot of storage, especially if it's like a you know, 2 terabyte thing, but that's fine, right? It's all replicated for me. It's highly available. They just added a new one recently, which is Readadly, Read Access Geo-Redundant Storage. So in this case, not only am I geo-redundant, but I've made that secondary one readable. So now I got kind of a sharding sort of concept where I could pummel that secondary from, let's say, my application that's running in Europe. Let's go after that secondary. Stop calling the primary over in the States. I can't write to it from there. It's fine. But that's a pretty cool way to split up some of my data and make these read-only copies available somewhere else in the world. Each one of these obviously comes with a different price point. These aren't just free, make me more redundant at no cost. But if these things matter to you, doing something like that's pretty cool, and I'll show you that in just a moment. In fact, that moment is right now. So let me switch to, I'm gonna have to keep switching between different presentation modes. Hopefully I don't give anyone a seizure. So let's talk through what I have for storage. So I've got my application. We'll walk through the components in just a moment. But I set up a storage account within my Azure environment. And I can see that I have set up a little blob here. I've got some containers. I have a TechEd container. And so I've put some images in there. It's URL addressable. I can see stuff that's in there. I've got a bunch of images of my product catalog. So what is my site? My site is, because I want things to look quasi-legitimate, I'm selling shapes. You know, buy yourself an isosceles triangle for your wife, you know, go home with an octagon, that's fine. So buy some shapes. It's a fully functional site. I can create accounts, I can add a shopping cart, I can do all sorts of stuff. And so I want to take this app, and this is the one I'm scaling out. But I don't want each one of these shapes to be on the local database or on the local server, right? I want to put these shapes somewhere else. So what I've done is taken all of those shapes and put those into blob storage, even including the logo for my website. Each one of those are sitting there in blob storage. From my code, it's really as simple as looking at one of those and referring to them, because they're all internet addressable. So if I want to look at my master, of course, why am I looking at that page? I'm going to open the wrong file. There we go. So in this case, if I look at my logo file, it's pulling the logo from blob storage. So in this case, I know that when I push this to the cloud, that's where I'm always going to this, right? I'm not hitting my local file system anymore that's sitting on my fleet of 30 servers or 20 servers. It's holidays and people are buying shapes for their friends and family. I'm up to 100 servers. I don't want to update this 100 times. I want to update this one time. I can do that by using this. Likewise, though, as we look at more configuration, so how do I want to make this more redundant? So if I look at the configuration options, you'll see the three options here that we just talked about. I can do locally redundant, geo-redundant, or read access geo-redundant, each one increasingly more expensive, each one using more of my credits. But once I have that, besides monitoring and things like that, you'll notice if I go back to my dashboard, it provides me the option here to hit a secondary endpoint, which is pretty cool. So now I can see both a primary endpoint and a secondary for my storage so that the version of this app that I deploy to Europe, again, can point to one, because that's the region I can push it to, versus the other. So there's hopefully a nice way, again, to build that sort of geo-redundant storage. Next up, the SQL database. So how do I take my database and push that to the cloud? So Microsoft Azure SQL, whatever it's called now, it used to be SQL Azure, that was so much simpler. I don't have SQL database. Either way, SQL database is out there, and this is database as a service, right? The whole point of database as a service is you're giving me a database where you do a lot of the work for me. You do the backups, you do the sizing of it, you do the tuning, you do whatever. I don't want to deal with any of that. I can't even access the server. So you're just giving me access at the database tier, not on the VMs it runs on or any of that. So in this case, that's really the point there, is how do I scale that, right? So I can scale those up. I can make SQL databases bigger and bigger. And I can also use custom sharding. I could write my own sharding algorithm that writes this across different databases instances. You can use SQL federations that work in Azure so that you can actually have a database that acts as a master but federates the work to other behind-the-scenes databases. That does work. But there's also redundancy built in here for active geo-replication. This just got added recently, where if you have a premium instance out there, they'll actually do geo-redundancy asynchronously to another database in another region. And again, that can fail over automatically. So, and you can make it readable. So once again, you kind of get this read-only shard out there where I can split up my data make this a copy of it and make it readable, another way to kind of make my SQL database appear more available across regions, even though the hub might be in the Western US, I can sell the local copy, if you will, somewhere in Europe or Asia Pacific. Let's look at that. So in this case, setting up a SQL database is pretty simple. I did not set up a premium one because I'm not made of money, so this one is a regular server. But what you can see, once you have one of these up, scaling them, in this case, is really about scaling horizontally. It's about picking different sizes, how much memory, how much should this have. If I pick a business edition, I can get some pretty big databases vertically. And so connecting to this is actually really nice. So I can use my local management studio still and connect up to that server. So I'm hitting a server there that's running up in Microsoft Azure. And I can work with it and administer it just like I would a regular database on premises. So just to prove I'm not making things up, let's quick look at our order database. When I actually submit an order, you believe me. We don't know each other that well yet. All right, so we'll prove that my orders database is empty. Sure enough, there's nothing in there, nothing up my sleeve. So there is nothing there. So my web application, what's great is it doesn't really have to care that this is on-premises or in the cloud. My database access code is completely the same when I'm running in this environment. So if I look at when I pull from a database, even on the home page, I'm still just doing my regular data access code. I'm doing my regular selects. The only difference is in my web config file, I've got a connection string that Azure even gives me, I guess just assuming I can't even type a connection string, which I can't. It gives me the actual connection string I need to just plug into my code, but that's the only change I really have to do. There are some caveats of things you can do in one versus the other, but those aren't too big. So I can really take a running app, switch its connection string, load that database in the cloud, and I have a cloud database, which is pretty nice, especially one that can become geo-redundant for me, scale it up. That works out nicely. I'm going to do a non sequitur because I forgot to show you on storage. The Visual Studio Server Explorer has actually gotten really nice. This started out as kind of lame, but it's actually gotten much less lame to actually being pretty cool, where I can now do a lot of stuff from here. So from my container, I can even upload files. I can do all sorts of stuff from here, putting things into storage. The key is, again, reducing friction, right? How easy is it for me to just do this stuff? They've done a great job recently of making this a very full-featured environment where I can connect to databases, talk to blob storage, and so forth. All right, where are we going next in our wild journey? After the database, we're hitting the website. So Azure website is pretty awesome. It's gotten to be a point where you can argue, or at least I did in an InfoQ article a month or so ago, is that this may be the most full-featured platform as a service available today from a web hosting perspective. In terms of breadth of capabilities of what's going on here, you've got to at least consider this among the Herokus of the world and other Google App Engine, other people who are in that PaaS space. Websites does a great job now. You're really using this for a web application hosting fabric. That's what you're getting here, right? You're not accessing the VM. You're accessing it where I'm pushing my web app to a fabric that's running .NET code, Node.js code, Java code, whatever. I can push it all up to a managed fabric that can auto-scale in and out. It can have bigger sizes up and down. It really makes it easy to manage this as a web app versus having to care about the infrastructure. And that's, so why did I put that in my infrastructure here? I don't want to deal with a VM. I don't want to configure IIS. I don't care about any of that. I just want to push my application. And I can do it right from Visual Studio. I can do it from GitHub. I can do it from Dropbox. I can do it from all sorts of places where I want to take code, push it to here, have it instantly get reflected. I'm actually going to show that off tomorrow in my talk on DevOps about pushing straight from check-in through build right to production with no changes. So hopefully this is a great way to take this web hosting fabric that goes in and out, it's a great place to host the web app that I'm building here. So for my web app, I've actually pushed this website to two places. So let me first show you the websites. I'm OK with that. So if we look at the websites, I've got two set up. First, I've got TechEd and TechEd Europe. So let's go ahead and take a look at the TechEd one, which is this one that's running right now on the public internet. As you can see, I've been abusing it all day. But from the monitoring information, I can see what's going on with the application. I can see on the scaling part, since we're talking about resiliency and scale, is because I'm using the expensive, not super expensive, but mildly expensive standard plan, I'm able to do lots of stuff. I can configure an instance size. I can say this thing should run on large machines for each instance, or small or medium. Then I can do some pretty cool auto-scaling stuff. So in this case, I could say, let's go ahead and scale based on a schedule, because I know every Friday night everyone does their timesheets and beats up this app. Let's scale it up. And then let's scale it right back down later when no one's doing their timesheets anymore. Or whatever. I can set things up on a fixed schedule, or I can scale by a metric and say, you know what, when CPU gets to be so much, go ahead and add this many instances to it, and then also you'll wind down when you're done. Or I can just say, forget it, I just want to add 5 instances. Go nuts and do that. So I've got lots of different ways that I can scale and build this redundantly within a data center. And that's the key, is this is within a region. All of what I'm building here is within a region. So if I want to make sure that if this region goes down, I can go somewhere else, I deploy another instance of the website and do that. And load balancing is built into this. So as soon as I add an instance, it's just there. I don't have to update load balancers, even though it's using the Azure load balancer underneath the covers. So from Visual Studio, what's great is that when I want to push my shape store and just publish, I can pick a publishing profile for one of my applications in my websites and then just push and publish from here, or hook this up to my Git repository or TFS or whatever I want to do. I can do instant push from these environments, which really makes it easy. Likewise, when I'm over here in the increasingly fancy left side console, I can take my web my application and do some other things. So I could take my tech ed app and stop it. I can attach debugger now, so you can do some local debugging of your website applications. I can do all sorts of stuff here from a management perspective. So this is taking my web app and not putting it on a VM that has a web server and configuration. It's taking it, publishing it up to a fabric, and within seconds, having it available on the public internet. Pretty cool. All right, so what's next? After we have our website working, where do we go next? So we go to the load balancer. So in this case, the whole point is, how do I distribute traffic across instances, right? I mean, a web app, it's going to be each individual web server and so forth. So what you're doing here is you're establishing a virtualized endpoint that then is going to route traffic to the underlying VMs. And when you configure a load balancer for the VMs, you get a public IP and a mapping to the private IP, so it balances it to the right servers. You can also define some probing protocols that will say, ping this to find out if this thing's healthy or not, right? And that's the point of a load balancer, is don't route traffic to bad servers. So you can actually define how to define what a bad server is. And saying, probe this protocol, hit this endpoint to know if this is, if not online anymore. If it's not, take it out of the load balancer pool, keep going. And I'm not going to show that, only because you can't see it in the websites, it's behind the scenes. For VMs, I haven't set one up yet. But when you do it for VMs, the cool thing is that you just get to add it to a new load balancer set. And again, this stuff happens automatically where you don't have to reconfigure much. You're just saying, add it to this load balance pool of servers. And we'll see that in action in a few moments. Where do we go next? So the service bus. So I say this in most examples, but the service bus is the only truly unique thing in Microsoft Azure, I think, at this point. I'm not saying the other stuff isn't great. This is an area that has not been inexplicably covered well by anybody else yet. And what this is a way to integrate applications, kind of the integration engine to some extent of Azure. And so I can have queues for durable messaging, one receiver. I can have topics, which let me publish a message and have any number of receivers subscribe on that message, kind of a publish-subscribe scenario. And I can have the relay, which is the only magic service in Azure, which lets me take an on-premises service, WCF, unfortunately. Maybe you love WCF, that shouldn't disparage it. But you can take your WCF service, add a specific binding, and it becomes available to the public internet. So imagine that local business service you just want to expose to a mobile app that someone's using. I can just use this relay binding and expose that publicly, which is pretty cool. So all of those come together nicely, especially in hybrid scenarios where I'm trying to link apps, but I want some level of durability in between. Because if something goes down, I don't want to lose that business transaction, that financial payment, whatever it is, I need some level of durability. So that's why I added that to this solution. So no more does my website publish new orders to my database. My website publishes all the new orders when I click purchase, drops them in a queue, and then I have a VM running that has a little job on it that pulls data off of that queue and then updates the database. So I'm doing some of that load leveling pattern, where if people are going crazy and buying shapes like crazy, my database is never going to get overloaded because my agents is going to keep sitting there, pulling one at a time, updating at a nice leisurely pace. If I want to, I can use VM auto-scaling and scale up that fleet of servers that are pulling it, right, and do that competing consumer model if my database can handle it. But that sort of model, the sort of offloading model, works really nicely when I want to distribute some heavy read traffic from the write traffic. I can do that easily by throwing a queue in between. So this does not have HA outside of a region built in. So I have a service bus namespace. There's redundancy within that namespace to make sure the message is stored multiple places. But if that whole region goes offline, service bus stuff is unavailable there. So you have a few architectural options that Microsoft points out here. You can do an active replication that says every time I interact with a queue, I pump it to two queues at the same time. Right? Here's the primary and the failover. And the hard part now on the other side, when I'm pulling things, obviously I'm getting duplicates every time. So I either need to know how to discard duplicates, or I simply have idempotent messages and I can publish the same thing twice and it doesn't matter. But you have to think about that. Or you do passive, which says I write to the queue. If the queue's offline, then I write to the secondary, and my listener can listen to both. Also valid. You could also potentially lose messages or get something funky there. But those are two different ways you can build some redundancy, high availability into a service bus scenario. So let's take a look at that. So if we look at the service bus in the console, whose shape I can never remember. So we'll go back to the beginning. Oh, that's right, it's this weird document with an arrow. So if I look at this, I can have a service bus namespace tied to a region. And within that, I can have queues, topics, relays, notification hubs, which is when I want to blast out a million messages at once to a mobile device or something, this works fantastic. And so I can look at queues, where I've set up an order queue. And so this order queue is active. I can see what's in it. I can see what the backlog is. For VM load balance or auto scale, which is pretty cool, is you can actually queue auto scaling off of the depth of the queue. So you can say, if this queue gets too big, auto scale me up another server that pulls from it for that competing consumer scenario. So tying your scale events to the queue depth is pretty cool. It's a nice way to see, do I actually have a big backlog of work? So for this particular queue, there's some basic configurations you can do, simply time to live sort of information and durability there. How long to keep a message, 14 days, detect duplicates or not, turn it on or off. So I can configure all this. From code, this is pretty easy. So when I want to interface with the queue, I can take my file that actually checks out when I make a purchase. I want to do a purchase, I can create an object. I create a queue client. I'm just going to serialize the shopping cart the person purchased into a JSON message. I wrap it into a brokered message, which takes in any object. And I just call send. And that drops it off to a queue. It'll return, you know, if something fails, it'll let me know. But it'll drop me off to the queue and just do its work. On the receiving side, I have that little agent guy that does stuff. And this guy just reads from the queue. And he just pulls the queue, client receive, and going to keep looping over that, pausing in between, and inserting the order into the database. So again, it doesn't matter if this thing has 1,000 things in there or 10, it's going to pick one off, update the database, pick one off, update the database. So if that's a creaky old database on premises and I don't want to upset it, it's very fragile, I can just do this, make it really easy to load level it. Next up is the VMs. So in this case, Azure VMs give you Windows and Linux servers in the cloud, right? That's what Azure Virtual Machines is. It's letting me run VMs in the cloud. So the key to remember here is that these VMs can restart without me knowing it. So there is an SLA around uptime, but VMs, for example, will restart when Microsoft patches the underlying Fabric servers. May only be every few months, but that server will restart. That's just the way it works. So is your app ready for your server to just go offline when you had no idea it was going to happen? You're not going to get a warning or an email ahead of time. It just kind of happens, and you just understand that can happen. Same with if the Fabric detects that that host is bad and moves it to another host, there could be a temporary blip as well. So are you able to handle these sort of uptime glitches or not? Now, one way Azure helps you with this is you can define an availability set. What that does, if I put five servers into an availability set, it splits it across fault domains. So it makes sure it's not tied to the same power supply or it's not on the same host. So that even if something went wrong or if in this case there was patching going on, it would never impact all the servers at one time. So you can at least spread your load across different machines knowing that these availability sets help you split it across. VMs also do work with autoscale, as I mentioned, so you can base it on queue depth, CPU consumption, other things to increase the fleet of servers you've got doing the VM work. So I'm going to use this, as we talked about, to run my little database update job. Let's take a look at that. So first we'll look in the portal at what we've got for VMs. This one icon I do remember. And so I've got one instance running. Schroeder Tech Ed database. And if I drill into that, I can do a few different things here. I can see the exposed endpoints. In this case, I've got a remote desktop PowerShell endpoint. I can look at the configuration of this and look at its sizing, what sizes it supports if I want to make it bigger. I can create an availability set. So this is where I can say, join these three servers to the same availability set so that things like updates and patches and whatever don't impact all my servers at one time. Likewise, configure some endpoint monitoring to check the health of my servers. And so when I look at the dashboard, I can also see how to connect. I can download an RDP file and jump right into my server if I'd like to. I did not jump into autoscale. It's fine. So in this case, I can RDP into this box. So this is my server running in Azure right now. Zoom in on the heading. You can read that. I'm not faking it. That's in Azure, not my machine. So I've got a little version of my Polar app going. So I can just run this character. And it's going to just keep polling the queue. So I'll get this running, and we'll submit an order in a few moments to see this actually hit the database. But again, imagine having a Windows service running on these boxes. It just starts up, starts interfacing with the queue, and then also updating the database. Whatever that service task should do, but again, this is stateless, right? If this whole server goes offline halfway through after I've read a message, I can recover from that, because until I delete it from the queue, it stays there. And so if my hold expires, let's say 30 minutes have gone by and I haven't deleted that message, the service bus queue knows that this guy's not coming back. I'm going to release it to another polar, which works great. So I can even handle a failure of a server because I'm maintaining zero state on this machine. This can go away right now and nothing goes wrong. All right, so this thing's doing its magic. And I will not shut down the server. That will make for a weird demo. All right. So that's my elastic pool of servers. Right now it's a pool of a single server, but imagine, again, scaling that fleet out. Next up is the cache. So in this case, what Azure Cache offers you is this distributed in-memory object cache that you can, again, build to be redundant. So you can store session in here. That's the easy, no-brainer home run scenario. Don't store session state on your server. That is the worst kind of state to have on a server. That means if I tear that server offline, that customer might have just lost some really cool stuff they put in their shopping cart or whatever. If I'm not putting my session state into a distributed environment, whether it's a database or in this case cache, I'm really sticking it to my customer. That's a bad kind of state. In this case, using cache is really, really easy to use for session state, but also imagine all sorts of things I might want to share across the fleet of servers, especially if people might hit a different server on each request. Here's different information, here's config values, maybe even database connection strings if you do it securely. A lot of different things you could put in this value without having to do reboots or changing code to update those values. So when you're doing high availability, what you can do is it actually replicates the cache objects to a different location. And so if the primary is down, it actually switches you to the secondary automatically for you. So because there's multiple writes happening, you will see a higher latency. Throughput will be impacted because it actually does a synchronous write to both locations at the same time. But that might be worth the trade-off of knowing if this region's offline, I haven't lost my cache. And so if we look at the cache quickly in my console, I don't remember what the cache icon looks like either anymore. Looks like a database with a lightning bolt. Makes sense. So I can have a cache here, and they're also plugging the new Redis cache they just announced a couple days ago. So you can do this with Redis. But in this case, my managed cache, I can see its cache hit rate, how many misses have I had. If I'm missing a lot of my cache and I'm probably not loading it properly, if I'm constantly looking for things that aren't there, maybe I need to do a cache warming pattern where when I start up my server, I load the cache with a bunch of relevant data versus a cache aside policy, which is a little more of a lazy loading. But you can configure the cache with different values. You can set an expiration policy. If I want to scale my cache, I can go up to 150 gigs of in-memory cache, which is pretty cool. That's a lot of space, I would think, for most applications. I can choose how much to allocate of my particular level to cache, what's available. And if I choose the crazy big cache, that's when I go to configure, I also have the option to choose high availability. So if I switch this to the premium cache, there'd be another column here that said HA, yes or no. So again, pretty easy to do all this via configuration. I don't have to update my code to reflect this. It just works. Instead, my code becomes really, really simple. So even though I'm using this for session, I just add a NuGet package for the caching. And what that did was add a couple of sections here around Windows Azure caching and says, what do you want to use? I want to use the AppFabric cache, which is technically the name of it sitting in Azure. It's going to use that immediately for session state, what's the name of the cache, and so forth. And instantly, my session state's here. So I know that it doesn't matter how many web servers I have, I'm using a distributed cache. A couple areas left to focus on. The next one is CDN. This is a relatively new service from Microsoft, still in preview, but the idea is, how do I deliver digital content to edge locations? How do I have users who might be sitting around the world who are never going to be close to where my website might be, let alone my database? How do I push these static resources even closer to the end user? So CDN is nice because the content delivery network, and Azure has it now, is because it can serve it from an edge location. In some cases, you have dozens of endpoints, depending on your cloud provider, where this gets pushed to, so that someone sitting in almost any major country has something within a good geographic reach of them to pull down video files, media, whatever you stick in there. That's going to really speed up the performance by using a CDN to push it not even just out of storage, but now a level further into a CDN provider. So I use that here to push my catalog images up to the public edge locations in the CDN. So we can see that in my database is I created the CDN. And then because the CDN actually hooks to the blob storage, I don't have to do anything. I can just say CDN service, here's where the blob storage is, have fun with that. So if we look at the CDN service, which again is still in preview, it's not super full featured yet. You can't expire content easily, so it's getting there. But it's a good start to what they've got. So I can set up a new CDN endpoint, and it has a URL associated with it. And it's tied to a particular instance, when I configure it, of my storage. And that's the origin domain here, which is in tiny blue font. So it's pointing to my blob storage. So when you spin one up, you say, where should I go for my content? And so it automatically is going there. So we can see that in action in my shape store. So if I refresh this for some reason, that didn't have to happen. I can look at where this is coming from. And I've updated my database, so it's actually pulling from the CDN instead. So it's not even pulling from blob storage anymore. It's pulling from the CDN, which means if someone's running this application in some other geography, they're getting images from the closest location to them, not from even where my blob storage is. So in just another layer of availability we've increased to make this app even more resilient, even if a blob storage primary or secondary goes down, this data is sitting in my edge locations. All right, the last one I want to show you is one of the new ones, which has kind of been in stealth beta, I think, for like 3 years, but it's finally available more publicly now, which is the Traffic Manager. This kind of completes our picture. Yes. There we go. So if we look at the Traffic Manager, what this does is DNS resolution for your endpoints. And so this isn't a load balancer per se, but what it does is take the traffic you're sending in, when it resolves the DNS name to give you to where to actually route you, it's using one of three different algorithms. You can choose a performance one, which is going to pick the one that has the lowest latency for where you're at. So imagine having websites in Asia Pacific, Europe, the US, a couple regions. When I make a request through Traffic Manager, it's going to say, this one's serving up websites at the lowest latency for you. I'm going to point you to Europe. I'm going to point you to here. So there's very intelligent resolution of the DNS names. There's also failover, which is the one I configured for my test, which is where you have a primary and a secondary. And if the primary goes offline, it just routes traffic immediately to the secondary. So the DNS resolution switches over to the secondary automatically for you. You don't have to do anything there. The final one is round robin. If I just want to distribute load across, let's say, a bunch of US regions, I can choose the round robin one, and traffic will just get routed in order, kind of no intelligence, but just routed to every single website. All of these I can configure myself, and this is how I span regions. Again, a website sits in a region. I can have 100 instances. That region goes offline, I'm done. Traffic manager means I can deploy to multiple regions, have something that sits higher than that, that then routes between them, which really gives me that, you know, this whole picture gives me that highly available, resilient application where I can arguably unplug any one of the individual components here, everything keeps running. And again, this isn't something that's super sophisticated. This is something we can all set up today using point-and-click services of a basic web app. I took a basic web application, can layer in these services very quickly. You know, switching this from Amazon to Azure took me about 45 minutes. Just wasn't that difficult. Once you do that, now I've got an application that's relatively bulletproof. There's still going to be some areas potentially where you can find a flaw. But for the most part, you've protected yourself against most failure of any major component and constantly built yourself a scalable architecture that can scale at every layer, right? I can make a bigger cache. I can change my database size, add more web servers, add more things to the load balancer. I can keep changing each tier. It's not a monolithic app that either scales all or nothing. So let's take a quick look at that one, which is a pretty cool service. I'm tempted to test it, although my testing was sketchy earlier. Probably my fault. Do I want to run the risk of my last demonstration being a failure? It's iffy. But if we look at Traffic Manager, you can see how it's configured. Makes a lot of sense that these are not alphabetical. So seriously, make it harder. So if we look at Traffic Manager, it's online. And you can add endpoints to it. Endpoints can be virtual machines. Endpoints can be websites. And I think I saw an announcement this week. This can now even be things outside of Azure. So you could fail over to your own location if you wanted to, or even set up primary at your location and fail over to the cloud. So some pretty cool things that are happening here. I've added two of my websites. These have to be standard websites. So if you have the free tier and try to look at this, it won't show up. I guess that is what it is. So I add that. For configuration, you set up a few things. Here's the DNS name that will resolve. So if you wanted to map your friendly name, you know, shapestore.biz, I could map that to this so that it routes it to this and routes it accordingly. I can set up a time to live. I set this as really short, just so if there's a failure, I can instantly resolve to the other endpoint. And I can pick my load balancing method. If it's performance-based, I don't have to choose anything. If it's failover, I pick a priority. What should be the primary? What should be the secondary? And so you can see here, this is hitting the traffic manager endpoint. And this is hitting it in the US. Allegedly, if I take off my website, this should just keep working. Can I say allegedly? Because I was probably my fault, hit or miss on this before. But let's roll the dice. If I go ahead and stop this for a moment, that's not going to take effect instantly. That DNS time to live comes into effect, right? So it's going to have 30 seconds of, in this case, because it's just one or the other, it wouldn't resolve. If I go ahead and flush my DNS settings so it doesn't look there, if I look up now, hopefully it returns the EU one, which it did. So now if I'm doing the names, if I'm doing the lookup, I can see it's returning tech at EU as your websites.net. So it's resolving to that location instead. So if I plug in my traffic manager URL, and I'll do it in a different browser just so there's no affinity to getting pinned to it from one browser instance. Sure enough, I am pleasantly surprised that worked right. I'm coming up from the EU. So this is serving it from the EU location as a failover without me really doing much. As soon as that failure was detected, this knew to roll over all DNS resolution back to my backup site. So if I put this back online, and actually show this whole thing working. Go ahead and start this back up. This may see if it comes back online already. It's always pretty quick when you take these on and off. We'll see if this comes online. It sure did. Let's see if this resolves back to the primary. It does. So this one, as you can see, now it resolves to my primary, which is in the US. So let's actually see this working so you have some faith in this not being a complete sham of a website. I'm going to add a couple things to my cart. Cylinders are hot this season. Let's go ahead and check out. I'll log myself in. If I were intelligent, I would have been using federated identity. Don't judge me. This was based on a time limit. All right, I'm gonna log in. We'll use a Visa. As you can see, I've done this a few times. Let's click Buy Now. And when I do that, it's writing it to the queue. And then from this queue, you'll see it already received the message. This stuff's really fast. So it already received the message in my little process that's running the queue. And if I query my database again, I hopefully have a new order in here. Sure enough, ladies and gentlemen. So that worked nice, right? It was able, I have decoupled workloads there. It's doing it through a queue, works cleanly, and it's all scalable across the different tiers. So hopefully this sort of architecture is something that looks appealing to you. It doesn't look like something that's scary, but it's pretty easy to put together. It's just thinking about ruthlessly your single points of failure. Where can things go wrong? Where will things go wrong? And how am I tackling those? So, you know, that's really your takeaway. Think about, how does your architecture scale before you move to the cloud? How does your architecture of your on-premise app, is it resilient on-premises? Because if it's not on-premises, it's not going to be in the cloud either. You've got to actively think about high availability. The great thing is that so many of these services build it in for you so that you can just configure things. It's not going to be magic, but you can configure it to scale automatically or this or that. So take advantage of what these services have and build these sort of apps that make sense. So with that, there's some related content about Azure websites today. There's one that's after this. The scalable end-to-end multi-tier looked pretty interesting. There's a SQL Server high availability with Azure one. There's a whole session on caching. And then the ALM with Azure is also should be handy if you're thinking about this space. Also, to simply flog my own work, tomorrow at 1:45 or 1:15, I'm doing a DevOps in the Microsoft space. So kind of continuing to talk about some of this. More information, lots of resources. Evaluations, everyone loves them. Clearly I do, so scan this code. Hopefully you enjoyed the session. This is a good topic, it's a fun topic. It's fun to try to break things. Instead of the old days where trying to unplug a server would have gotten you killed by someone in ops. Now, you know, you should be unplugging servers on purpose. You should be purposely seeing where does your app fall apart. So have fun with this. I appreciate your time and feel free to ask any questions. We've got a couple minutes left. Question, the handsome gentleman on the right.
All of these things, the blob, the cache, the VMs, how do you configure security for those? And can you do it, like you said, in one spot?
So the question was, how do you secure some of the blobs, the storage, the cache, all these different services? In some cases, they are just still using the single set of credentials that come in with your Azure account. There's not a whole lot of sophisticated role-based access yet in this environment, so it's not like you can say you can just do this and you can just do that. Some of these have unique credentials. It's not completely joined yet, but even Azure AD has made it easier to say, let's even use Azure AD credentials with Azure itself. So they're starting to come together where you're not maintaining isolated credentials for each. And for the most part, they're pretty integrated today. Yeah, question?
So is that something that's going to come to the private cloud as well?
For service bus, yeah, question is it going to come to private cloud? So today the Azure pack supports, well, more importantly, you can run service bus for Windows. It's a download available today that lets you run the queues and the topics on premises. The relay is unique to cloud, but right now you could run queues and topics on premises with an Azure dashboard using the Azure pack and get a simulated kind of pub sub, which is actually pretty nice. It's a lot better than just using MSMQ or in some cases using a full-blown integration bus, which is overkill. Okay, if no other questions, again, thanks, I'll be up here.